This is Audible.
You are listening to Christian Audio's production of Every Man's Battle, Winning the War on Sexual Temptation, One Victory at a Time, by Stephen Arterburn, Fred Stoker, with Mike Yorkey. This book is read by Dean Gallagher. This audio recording was produced in 2011 by Christian Audio, which owns the copyright. No portion of this recording may be reproduced for any reason without prior written consent from Christian Audio. Recorded by arrangement with Waterbrook Press, an imprint of the Crown Publishing Group, a division of Random House, Inc. Published in association with the literary agency group of Alive Communications, Inc., 7680 Goddard Street, Suite 200, Colorado Springs, Colorado, 80920. Originally published in English as Every Man's Battle, Winning the War on Sexual Temptation, One Victory at a Time, copyright 2000, by Stephen Arterburn, Fred Stoker, and Mike Yorkey. All rights reserved. Please visit christianaudio.com, facebook.com/christianaudio, or twitter.com/christianaudio to offer your impressions of this work and to explore additional titles. Foreword by Stephen Arterburn. Being part of the Everyman series has been one of the great joys of my life. If I'd written and published only this one series, I would have been completely fulfilled. I owe all this to Fred, who lived out this message long before he was called by God to write about it. Now, it may sound strange to some, but I believe Fred had one of those rare experiences where God interrupts what we're doing and gives us a new mission. I'm quite confident God spoke to him directly. Fred's coming to me with his manuscript was also part of God's plan, and I am so glad for it. As a result, my life has been filled with words I could never replace, in the form of emails, letters, hugs, crying eyes, and expressions of gratitude. Here are a few comments from the men. Thank you. You've saved my marriage. I am now the man I always wanted to be, living the life I always wanted to live. Oh, this feeling of freedom. I feel so clean. I don't know where I would be today if it were not for this book. And from the wives. Thank you for giving the man I married back to me. We would not still be married if not for this book. I wish you could see the man my husband has become today. My man was totally transformed reading your book. I've received these kinds of messages every day. I never go into Christian bookstores, but I was jogging one day and stopped in one. Staring back at me was your book. I was compelled by it. I ran home, got my money, and came back and bought it. It changed everything. Somebody gave me this book about 5 years ago, and right before I was about to go back online, there it was looking up at me from the floor. I picked it up and read it through my tears. Our marriage has been healed. Years ago at New Life, we started an Every Man's Battle workshop weekend. More than 6,000 men have attended since that time. For a few men, it was just a way to get someone off their backs. But for almost all, it's been the start of a whole new life. One of my favorite stories is of a husband who came because his wife demanded it. After the conference, he confessed his affair. He was truly repentant and said he would do anything to make it up to her. She asked him to sign over all the property and assets to her, because the name on them wouldn't matter if he was truly finished with his lust and adultery. She asked him to shave his chest, and she asked him to get braces on his teeth. He did all three because he realized his actions had humiliated her, and he was willing to do anything to humble himself and win back her heart. I speak to them both regularly, and they are doing well. I'm so glad you have come upon this book. For some reason, God has put it in front of you. I'm not just hoping you'll read it. I'm hoping you'll live it. And while I know personally that every marriage can't be saved, I know that every man can reclaim his sexual integrity and every spouse can fully heal. Every man can walk with his head held high, free, honorable, and a man after God's own heart. It doesn't really matter what you've done. It's no worse than what others have done. And it doesn't matter where you've been. Others have been down that path before. What matters is what you are willing to do now and what you will choose to do. You may have thought you were entitled to do the things you did, but now your entitlement is to live clean, renewed, and without even a hint of impurity. I challenge you to join the millions across this country who have reclaimed their integrity, their faith, and their respect. If Fred and I can do it, those who know us would confirm this. You can certainly do it too. This book is often quite explicit in how the co-authors describe past struggles, their own and others, with sexual purity. For the sake of communicating honestly with readers who face similar struggles, our goal has been to achieve frankness without causing offense, thereby making it easier for men to face up to any uncleanness and to press forward by God's grace and power into actively sharing His holiness. Introduction. Four Men and This Book's Story. From editor Mike Yorkie. I suppose it could be said that every book is an author's labor of love, but this book is a labor of God's love for you, the reader. God has heard a cry from men living in a sexually charged culture, and He has responded by bringing together four men in an unlikely fashion. We feel that the story of how this book arrived in your hands bears an important message to your heart. I first met Fred Stoker by telephone back in 1995, while I was editor of Focus on the Family magazine. Fred had submitted an article he called The Art of the Handoff, describing how he used Dr. James Dobson's book, Preparing for Adolescence, to educate his 11-year-old son, Jason, about the birds and the bees. Fred's insightful article arrived in the Focus on the Family mailbags unsolicited. In other words, his submission was one of nearly 1,000 that would-be authors sent our way each year, hoping his or her article would be selected for publication. Fred didn't know we had room in the magazine for only 12 unsolicited articles each year. But as I skimmed through Fred's manuscript, something about his first-person story resonated with me, and within a few months, we published it. Sometime later, after I'd moved with my family to San Diego and begun a full-time writing career, Fred sent me a surprise FedEx package. Inside was a thick manuscript. In a cover letter, Fred mentioned that he'd labored evenings, weekends, and months over it, and that he'd already gone through the heart-stopping experience of showing it to his wife, Brenda. She gave the manuscript a thumbs up, and now Fred needed the opinion of a professional writer and editor. Since I was the only such person he knew, Fred wondered if I wouldn't mind giving it a quick read. I sat down with Fred's manuscript and was immediately captured by the subject, one that makes most authors beat around the bush. But here was a guy exposing his life story and the life stories of other men, ogling women, dreaming about sexual acts with female acquaintances, sexualized what-ifs and double entendres, rampant masturbation. Fred's writing needed structural work and tightening, not unexpectedly since this was his first manuscript. But beneath the wordiness lay a treasure trove of truth that could impact a generation of men toward sexual integrity. As I relayed those thoughts to Fred, he asked me to consider rewriting the manuscript for him. I said yes after more discussion with Fred and prayer, but this wasn't an easy decision. I had just begun a freelance writing career, and choosing the right projects was critical. It's very difficult for first-time authors such as Fred to find a publisher willing to take them on, and I knew his manuscript might never see the light of a publishing day. We plugged ahead, however, trusting God that if He really wanted this message out, He would provide a publisher. Waterbrook Press was God's answer. From publisher Dan Rich. When I read Mike and Fred's manuscript, I was immediately struck by its potential. Here was an example of what we at Waterbrook look for most: books that offer Christians encouragement, support, and challenge by authors who can communicate old truths through new eyes and lead readers to renewed hope and redemption. The manuscript could stand on its own, but in our planning sessions, we agreed its impact could be much greater if we added the voice of an experienced and widely respected counselor. The perfect fit, we decided, was Steve Arterburn. He had authored or co-authored 35 books, had founded a chain of mental health facilities called the New Life Clinics, and was co-host of the national radio program New Life Live. We asked Steve to come on board and were delighted when he said yes. In the finished book, the separate contributions of Steve and Fred generally have been blended together with a we point of view, except where they narrate specific situations from their own experience and background. From co-author Steve Arterburn, I eagerly accepted the offer to help shape this book because I believe so much in the topic. In my first phone call to Fred after digging into the manuscript, I told him I believed this book could transform more marriages more deeply than nearly any marriage book I could think of. How can a book on male sexual purity transform marriages? Because I've found that sexual sins are the termites in the walls and foundations of today's marriages. On my call-in New Life Live radio broadcasts, it isn't uncommon to receive several calls each week from men desperate for freedom from impure thought lives and ungodly sexual actions. I'm sure many more men would call if they didn't feel so ashamed. But I can confidently state that the book you now hold, Every Man's Battle, has the potential to free you to love your wife in ways you never dreamed possible. We've changed the names of people in this book and have even changed a few details of their stories to protect their identities. But their stories are real. They're the stories of pastors, worship leaders, deacons, and elders. They're the stories of white-collar office workers and blue-collar employees. All of them are people who were caught in a terrible snare, just as we once were. Pursuing sexual integrity, however, is a controversial topic. I've taken heat when I've addressed it on my radio show, and Fred has also received slings and arrows when he's taught or spoken on this subject. We've been ridiculed by the world's sophisticates who find God's standard ridiculous and confining. That's fine with us, because we have a bigger concern. You. You're in a tough position. You live in a world awash with sensual images available 24 hours a day in a variety of mediums. Print, television, videos, the internet, even phones. But God offers you freedom from the slavery of sin through the cross of Christ. And He created your eyes and mind with an ability to be trained and controlled. We simply have to stand up and walk by His power in the right path. Men need a battle plan, and you'll have one when you finish reading Every Man's Battle, a detailed plan for becoming a man of sexual integrity. We've also included a study and discussion guide in the back of the book for your individual use or in a men's group. We believe that Every Man's Battle is a great resource for your church's men's retreat. While Fred and I will be speaking here from the perspective of married men, Every Man's Battle isn't just for hitched guys. The principles we describe apply also to the many teens and young adult men who must deal with the issue of sexual integrity while single. Believe us, marriage is no cavalry rescue from sexual temptation. So we've put forth principles to help keep young single men from lusting or developing addictive behavior and to increase their odds of marrying the right person. While Every Man's Battle is directed to men, it can also give women a greater understanding of what men are up against as they battle the age-old problem of the eyes. For that reason, each of the book's six parts concludes with the section called The Heart of the Woman, based on interviews we conducted with women. From co-author Fred Stoker, sexual immorality once held me captive. And after being liberated, I wanted to help other men cleanse themselves from this sin. After teaching on the topic of male sexual purity in Sunday school, I was approached one day by a man who said, I always thought that since I was a man, I would not be able to control my roving eyes. I didn't know it could be any other way. Now I'm free. Conversations like that thrilled my heart and confirmed the desire God gave me to help other men out of this quagmire. As other men approached me and shared their stories of sexual sin, many asked me to write a book. At first, I passed this off as simple complimentary talk. After all, anything I committed to paper had little chance of being published. I'd never written a book before. I wasn't the host of a national radio show. I didn't have a PhD. I hadn't studied in seminary. So why did I start writing a book? Because I felt deeply that if God would grant me such a voice in His kingdom, I could help give even more men some practical steps toward victory and help set them free to help others. The following verse inspired me to keep plodding away on this book night after night, month after month. Have mercy on me, O God, according to your unfailing love. According to your great compassion, blot out my transgressions. Restore to me the joy of your salvation and grant me a willing spirit to sustain me. Then I will teach transgressors your ways, and sinners will turn back to you. Psalm number 51, verses 1, 12, and 13. Get it? God's plan is to set sinners free and then use them to teach others. God has been using me in just that way, and I trust He will use you as well. Are you anxious to get started? Good, so am I. We need real men around here, men of honor and decency, men with their hands where they belong and their eyes and minds focused on Christ. If roving eyes or sexually impure thoughts or even sexual addictions are issues in your life, Steve and I are hoping you'll do something about it. Isn't it time? Part 1. Where are we? Chapter 1. Our Stories. But among you there must not be even a hint of sexual immorality or of any kind of impurity. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 3. If there's a single Bible verse that captures God's standard for sexual purity, this is it. And it compels this question. In relation to God's standard, is there even a hint of sexual impurity in your life? For both of us, the answer to that question was yes. From Steve, Collision. In 1983, my wife Sandy and I celebrated our first anniversary. One sun-splashed Southern California morning that year, feeling good about life and our future, I hopped into our 1973 Mercedes 450 SL, the car of my dreams, white with a black top. I'd owned it for just 2 months. I was tooling northbound through Malibu on my way to Oxnard, where I'd been asked to testify in a court hearing about whether a hospital should add an addiction treatment center. I'd always loved driving along the PCH, as locals called the Pacific Coast Highway. These four lanes of blacktop hugged the Golden Coastline and provided a close-up view of LA's beach culture. With the top down and the wind blowing in my face, I found that summer morning a good day to be alive. I never intentionally set out to be girl watching that day, but I spotted her about 200 yards ahead and to the left. She was jogging toward me along the coastal sidewalk. From my sheepskin-covered leather seat, I found the view outstanding, even by California's high standards. My eyes locked on to this goddess-like blonde, rivulets of sweat cascading down her tanned body as she ran at a purposeful pace. Her jogging outfit, if it could be called that in those days before sports bras and spandex, was actually a skimpy bikini. As she approached on my left, two tiny triangles of tie-dyed fabric struggled to contain her ample bosom. I can't tell you what her face looked like. Nothing above the neckline registered with me that morning. My eyes feasted on this banquet of glistening flesh as she passed on my left, and they continued to follow her lithe figure as she continued jogging southbound. Simply by lustful instinct, as if mesmerized by her gait, I turned my head further and further, craning my neck to capture every possible moment for my mental video camera. Then, blam! I might still be marveling at this remarkable specimen of female athleticism if my Mercedes hadn't plowed into a Chevelle that had come to a complete stop in my lane. Fortunately, I was traveling only 15 miles per hour in the stop-and-go traffic, but the mini collision crumpled my front bumper and crinkled the hood, and the fellow I smacked into didn't appreciate the considerable damage to his rear end. I got out of the car embarrassed, humiliated, saturated with guilt, and unable to offer a satisfying explanation. No way would I tell this guy, "Well, if you'd seen what I saw, you'd understand." 10 more years in the darkness. Nor could I tell the truth to my beautiful wife, Sandy. That evening, I put my best spin on the morning's unfortunate event in Malibu. You see, Sandy, it was stop and go, and I was reaching down to change the radio channel, and the next thing I knew, I rammed into a Chevy. Lucky no one was hurt. Actually, my young marriage was hurt, because I was cheating Sandy out of my full devotion, although I didn't know it at the time. Nor was I aware that although I'd vowed to commit my life to Sandy, I hadn't totally committed my eyes to her. I continued in the darkness for another 10 years before realizing I needed to make dramatic changes in the way I looked at women. From Fred, Wall of Separation. It happened every Sunday morning during our church worship service. I'd look around and see other men with their eyes closed, freely and intensely worshiping the God of the universe. Myself, I sensed only a wall of separation between the Lord and me. I just wasn't right with God. As a new Christian, I imagined I just didn't know God well enough yet. But nothing changed as time passed. When I mentioned to my wife Brenda that I felt vaguely unworthy of him, she wasn't the least surprised. "Well, of course," she exclaimed. "You've never felt worthy to your own father. Every preacher I've known says that a man's relationship with his father tremendously impacts his relationship with his heavenly father." "You could be right," I allowed. I hoped it was that simple. I mulled it over as I recalled my days of youth. What kind of man are you? My father, handsome and tough, was a national wrestling champion in college and a bulldog in business. Aching to be like him, I began wrestling in junior high. But the best wrestlers are natural-born killers, and I didn't have a wrestler's heart. My dad was coaching wrestling at the time at the high school in our small town of Albernett, Iowa. Though I was still in junior high, he wanted me to wrestle with the older guys, so he brought me to the high school workouts. One afternoon, we were practicing escapes, and my partner was in the down position. While grappling on the mat, he suddenly needed to blow his nose. He straightened up, pulled his t-shirt to his nose, and violently emptied the contents onto the front of his shirt. We quickly returned to wrestling. As the up man, I was supposed to keep a tight grip on him. Reaching around his belly, my hand slid into his slimy t-shirt. Sickened, I let him go. Dad, seeing him escape so easily, dressed me down. "What kind of a man are you?" he roared. Staring hard at the mat, I realized that if I had a wrestler's heart, I would have cranked down tightly and ridden out my opponent, maybe grinding his face into the mat in retaliation. But I hadn't. I still wanted to please Dad, so I tried other sports. At one baseball game after striking out, I remember hanging my head on the way back to the dugout. "Get your head up," he hollered for all to hear. I was mortified. Then he wrote me a long letter detailing my every mistake. Years later, after I'd married Brenda, my father felt she had too much control in our marriage. "Real men take charge of their households," he said. The monster. Now, as Brenda and I discussed my relationship with my dad, she suggested I might need counseling. "It surely couldn't hurt," she said. So I read some books and counseled with my pastor, and my feelings toward Dad improved. But I continued to feel that distance from God during the Sunday morning worship services. The true reason for that distance slowly dawned on me. There was a hint of sexual immorality in my life. There was a monster lurking about, and it surfaced each Sunday morning when I settled in my comfy lazy boy and opened the Sunday morning newspaper. I would quickly find the department store inserts and begin paging through the colored newsprint filled with models posing in bras and panties. Always smiling, always available. I loved lingering over each ad insert. "It's wrong," I admitted, "but it's such a small thing." It was a far cry from Playboy, I told myself. I peered through the panties, fantasizing. Occasionally, a model reminded me of a girl I once knew, and my mind rekindled the memories of our times together. I rather enjoyed my Sunday mornings with the newspaper. As I examined myself more closely, I found I had more than a hint of sexual immorality. Even my sense of humor reflected it. Sometimes a person's innocent phrase, even from our pastor, struck me with a double sexual meaning. I would chuckle, but I felt uneasy. Why do these double entendres come to my mind so easily? Should a Christian mind create them so nimbly? I remembered that the Bible said that such things shouldn't even be mentioned among the saints. I'm worse, I even laugh at them. And my eyes? They were ravenous heat-seekers searching the horizon, locking on any target with sensual heat. Young mothers leaning over in shorts to pull children out of car seats. Soloists with silky shirts. Summer dresses with décolletage. My mind, too, ran wherever it willed. This had begun in my childhood when I found Playboy magazines under Dad's bed. He also subscribed From Sex to Sexty, a publication filled with jokes and comic strips with sexual themes. When Dad divorced Mom and moved to his bachelor's pad, he hung a giant velvet nude in his living room, overlooking us as we played cards on my Sunday afternoon visits. Dad gave me a list of chores around his place when I was there. Once I came across a nude photo of his mistress. On another occasion, I found an 8-inch ceramic dildo which he obviously used in his kinky sex games. Hope for the hopeless. All this sexual stuff churned deep inside me, destroying a purity that wouldn't return for many years. Settling into college, I soon found myself drowning in pornography. I actually memorized the dates when my favorite softcore porn magazines arrived at the local drugstore. I especially loved the Girls Next Door section of Gallery Magazine, featuring pictures of nude girls taken by their boyfriends and submitted to the magazine. Far from home and without any Christian underpinnings, I descended by small steps into a sexual pit. The first time I had sexual intercourse, it was with a girl I knew I would marry. The next time, it was with a girl I thought I would marry. The time after that, it was with a good friend that I might learn to love. Then it was with a female I barely knew who simply wanted to see what sex was like. Eventually, I had sex with anyone at any time. After 5 years in California, I found myself with 4 steady girlfriends simultaneously. I was sleeping with 3 of them and was essentially engaged to marry 2 of them. None knew of the others. These days in my class for premarital couples, I often ask the women what they would think of a man with 2 fiancés. My favorite response? He's a hopeless pig. And I was hopeless, living in a pigsty. Why do I share all this? First, so you'll know that I understand what it's like to be sexually ensnared in a deep pit. Second, I want to provide you with hope. As you'll soon see, God worked with me and lifted me out of that pit. If there's even a hint of sexual immorality in your life, He will work with you as well. Chapter 2, Paying the Price. From Fred, Knowing Who to Call. Despite the deepening pit I occupied in my single days, I didn't notice anything wrong with my life. Oh, sure, I attended church sporadically, and from time to time the pastor's words penetrated my heart. But who was he? Besides, I loved my girlfriends. No one's getting hurt, I reasoned. My dad had eventually remarried, and when I visited back home in Iowa, my stepmother occasionally dragged me across the river to the Moline Gospel Temple in Moline, Illinois. The gospel was clearly preached. but to me the whole scene was clearly ludicrous. I often laughed cynically. Those people are crazy. After graduating from Stanford University with an honors degree in sociology, I decided to take a job in the San Francisco area as an investment advisor. One spring day in May, I stayed late at the office. Everyone else had gone home, leaving me alone with some troubling thoughts. I swiveled my chair around and propped my feet on the credenza to gaze into a typically grand California sunset. That evening, as the sun dipped beneath the horizon, I suddenly saw in full clarity what I had become. What I saw was hopelessly ugly. Where once I was blind, now I could see. Instantly, I saw my deep, deep need for a savior. Because of the Moline Gospel Temple, I knew whom to call upon. My prayer that day was born out of the simplicity of a certain heart. Lord, I'm ready to work with you if you're ready to work with me. I stood up and walked out of the office, not yet fully realizing what I had just done. But God knew, and it seemed as if all heaven moved into my life. Within 2 weeks, I had a job back in Iowa and a new life ahead of me, and no girlfriends. Feeling good. Back in Iowa, I began attending a marriage class led by Joel Budd, the associate pastor of my new church. It wasn't long before I realized that I knew nothing about treating women properly. Perhaps it was because my mom and dad were divorced, and I never saw a loving relationship modeled at home. More likely, however, it was because of my own selfishness and sexual sin. Everything I knew about women came from one-night stands and casual dating relationships. I didn't date during that year under Joel's teaching. I might have been the only man in history to attend a married couples class for a whole year without even having so much as a single date. But just before the 12-month mark, I prayed this simple prayer. Lord, I've been in this class for a year and have learned a lot about women, but I'm not sure I've ever seen these things in real life. I've never really known any Christian girls. Please show me a woman who embodies these godly characteristics. I wasn't asking for a date, girlfriend, or spouse. I just wanted to see these teachings in practice, in real life, that I might understand them better. God did far more than that. 1 week later, he introduced me to my future wife, Brenda, and we fell in love. Out of our commitment to Christ, Brenda and I decided to stay pure before marriage. She was a virgin, and I wished I were. We did kiss, however, and whoa, our lip smacking was wonderful. It was my first experience of something I would later discover far more deeply, the physically gratifying payoff that comes from obedience to God's sexual standards. In a song made popular during my senior year in college, the singer mourned about trying to remember how it used to feel when a kiss was something special. The lyrics from the song resonated sadly with me because at that point in my life, a kiss meant nothing to me. It was a joyless prerequisite on the path to intercourse. Something was deeply wrong. But now, having cut way back, in my experience with Brenda, the simple kiss became thrilling again. To an old sex hog like me, this was totally unexpected. As God continued to work in my life, Brenda and I married, honeymooned in Colorado, then settled into a new apartment building on the edge of a cornfield in a Des Moines suburb. Is this heaven? I surely thought so. Time passed, and at first I was feeling good. While I was once engaged to two women at the same time, I was now happily married to one woman. While I once drowned in pornography, since my wedding day I hadn't purchased a pornographic magazine. Given my track record, this was remarkable. Stopping short. I threw myself into my sales career and my leadership roles at church. Then I became a dad. I relished it all, and my Christian image shined brighter and brighter. By worldly standards, I was doing great. Just one little problem. By God's standard of sexual purity, I wasn't even close to living His vision for marriage. Clearly, I'd taken steps toward purity, but I was learning that God's standards were higher than I'd ever imagined, and that my Father had higher hopes for me than I had dreamed. It soon became clear that I'd stopped far short of holiness. There were the ad inserts, the double entendres, the heat-seeking eyes. My mind continued to daydream and fantasize over old girlfriends. These were more than a hint of sexual immorality. I was paying the price, and the bills were piling up. First, I could never look God in the eye. I could never fully worship Him. Because I dreamed of being with other women and rather enjoyed mentally recalling past sexual conquests, I knew I was a hypocrite, and I continued feeling distant from God. People around me disagreed, saying, "Oh, come on, nobody can control their eyes and mind, for heaven's sake. God loves you. It must be something else." But I knew differently. My prayer life was feeble. Once my son was very sick and had to be rushed to the emergency room. Did I rush into prayer? No, I could only rush others to pray for me. "Have you called our pastor to pray?" I asked Brenda. "Have you called Ron? Have you called Red to pray?" I had no faith in my own prayers because of my sin. My faith was weak in other ways as well. As a full commission salesperson, if I lost a number of deals in a row to the competition, I could never be sure if those setbacks weren't somehow caused by my sin. I had no peace. I was paying a price for my sin. My marriage was suffering as well. Because of my sin, I couldn't commit 100% to Brenda out of fear that she might dump me later. That cost Brenda in closeness. But that's not all. Brenda told me she was experiencing frightening dreams in which she was being chased by Satan. Was my immorality causing spiritual protection to be taken away from her? My wife was paying a price. At church, I was an empty suit. I came to church desperately needing ministry and forgiveness. I never arrived ready to minister to others. Of course, my prayers were no more effective in God's house than anywhere else. My church was paying a price. I remember listening to one sermon in which the pastor talked about generational sin. Patterns of sin passed from father to son. Exodus chapter 34, verse 7. Sitting in my pew, I recalled that my grandfather had run off from his wife in the middle of the Great Depression, leaving her with 6 kids to raise. My father left his family to pursue multiple sexual affairs. That same pattern had been passed to me, proven by my own multiple affairs in college. Though saved, I now found that I still didn't have this purity issue settled in my mind, and I was scared by the thought of passing this pattern on to my kids. My children could be paying a price. I finally made the connection between my sexual immorality and my distance from God. I was paying hefty fines in every area of my life. Having eliminated the visible adulteries and pornography, I looked pure on the outside to everyone else. But to God, I'd stopped short. I'd merely found a middle ground, somewhere between paganism and obedience to God's standard. Desperation. God desired more for me. He had freed me from the pit. But I had stopped moving toward Him. Having seen the prices I paid and my distance from God, I decided it was time to move closer. I expected the journey to be easy. After all, I had decided to eliminate pornography and affairs, and they were gone. I figured I could stop the rest of this sexual junk just as easily. But I couldn't. Every week I said I wouldn't look at those ad inserts. But every Sunday morning, the striking photos compelled me. Every week, I'd vow to avoid watching R-rated sexy movies when I traveled. But every week, I'd fail, sweating out tough battles and always losing. Every time I gazed at some glistening jogger, I'd promise to never do it again. But I always did. What I'd done was simply trade the pornography of Playboy and Gallery for the pornography of ad inserts and other magazine ads. The affairs? I'd simply traded the physical liaisons for mental affairs and daydreams, affairs of the eyes and heart. The sin remained because I'd never really changed, never rejected sexual sin, never escaped sexual slavery. I'd merely exchanged masters. A couple of months slipped by, then a couple of years. The distance from God grew wider, the bills stacked higher, and my impurity still ruled me. My faith waned further with each failure. Each desperate loss caused more desperation. While I could always say no, I could never mean no. Something was gripping me, something relentless, something mean. Like Steve, I eventually found total freedom. Since then, both Steve and I have had the chance to talk to men ensnared in sensual pits. Trapped and desperate to be free, their stories grip the heart. Now that you've heard my story, maybe you'll relate to the men in these next few pages as well. Chapter 3. Addiction or Something Else? Before men experience victory over sexual sin, they're hurting and confused. Why can't I win at this, they think. As the fight wears on and the losses pile higher, we begin to doubt everything about ourselves, even our salvation. At best, we think that we're deeply flawed. At worst, evil persons. We feel very alone since men speak little of these things. But we're not alone. Many men have fallen into their own sexual pits. From Fred, are you noticing? These pitfalls happen easily since much of the sexual immorality in our society is so subtle we sometimes don't recognize it for what it is. One day a fellow named Mike was telling me about renting the video Forrest Gump. Boy, it was great, he exclaimed. Tom Hanks was brilliant. I laughed and cried all the way through it. I know you and Brenda rent good movies for your kids. You should really get this one. It was really clean and wholesome. No, we won't be bringing Forrest Gump into our living room, I responded. Taken aback, Mike asked, why? It was a great movie. Well, do you remember that scene at the beginning where Sally Field has sex with the principal to get her son into the right school? And how about the bare breasts at the New Year's party? The nude onstage guitar performance? And in the end, when Forrest finally got the girl in the sex scene, she conceived a child out of wedlock. These aren't the types of things I want my kids to see. Mike slumped into a chair. I guess I've been watching movies for so long, I didn't even notice those things. Are you noticing? Think about it. Suppose you drop your kids at grandma's for the weekend and decide to watch Forrest Gump with your wife. You rent the video, pop some corn, put your arm around your wife, and hit play. After much laughter and tears, you both agree that Forrest Gump was a great movie. But you got more than entertainment, didn't you? Remember the grunting and panting between Sally Field and the principal? And how when Sally Field next appeared on screen, you briefly looked her up and down and wondered what it might be like to have her under the sheets? You had your arm around your wife while you were thinking it. Then later, after you retired to bed for a bit of sport with your wife, you replaced your wife's face with Sally Field's. And you wondered why she couldn't make you grunt and pant like the principal. Come on, you reply, this stuff happens all the time. Could be, but listen to these troubling words from Jesus. I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Matthew chapter 5, verse 28. In light of this scripture, piddling things like objecting to Forrest Gump may not be minor legalistic meddling. Such subtle influences added to hundreds of others over time provide more than a hint of sexual immorality in our lives. Soon the effect isn't so subtle anymore, and not so fun. Struggles all around. Let us share some other stories with you. Thad is recovering from drug dependency at a local Christian ministry. I've been trying hard to get my life in order, he told us. At the drug center, I've learned more about myself and my addiction to drugs. I expected that since that's why I went there, but I've discovered a second unexpected thing. I have a problem with lust and impurity. I want to be free, but I'm becoming frustrated and angry with the church. The Bible says that women should dress modestly, but they don't. The women soloists are always wearing the latest, tightest fashions. I look at them, but all I see are curves and legs. You know that one who always wears the slit way up the thigh? That thigh flashes with every step she takes. I just get enraged. Why do they make it worse? Howard, a Sunday school teacher, described a life-twisting event in junior high. I was walking home, and Billy and I stopped by the store to pick up something to drink. I didn't really like Billy, but I felt sorry for him. He didn't have many friends, and he was trying so hard to make some. On the way to the store, he told me about something called masturbation. I'd never heard that word, and he explained what it was. He said all the guys had been experimenting. I couldn't get what he told me out of my mind, and so that night I tried it. I haven't gone more than a week without masturbating for over 15 years now. I always thought marriage would take the desire away, but it isn't any better, and I am so ashamed. Not so much by the act itself, but by the things I think about and the movies I watch while doing it. I know it's adulterous. Joe told us he loves women's beach volleyball. At night, I've had shockingly vivid dreams with these women, he confided. Some have been so exhilarating and so real that I wake up the next morning certain that I've been in bed with them. Heavy with guilt, I wonder where my wife is, sure she has left me over this affair, and wondering how I could have done such a thing. Finally, as the cobwebs clear, it slowly dawns on me that it was just a dream. But even then, I feel uneasy. You want to know why? Because while I know it was just a dream, I'm not at all certain it wasn't some form of adultery. Wally, a businessman and frequent traveler, told us he absolutely dreads hotels. I always eat a long, leisurely supper, he says, stalling before returning to my room because I know what's coming. Before long, I have the TV remote in my hand. I tell myself it'll only be for a minute, but I know I'm lying. I know what I really want. I'm hoping to catch a little sex scene or two as I search the channels. I tell myself that I'll only watch for a while or that I'll stop before I get carried away. Then my motor gets going and I lust for more, sometimes even turning to the X-rated channel. The RPMs are going so high I have to do something or it feels like my engine will blow. So I masturbate. On a few occasions I fight it, but if I do later on when I turn the lights out, I'm flooded with lustful thoughts and desires. I stare wide-eyed at the ceiling. I see nothing, but I literally feel the bombardment, the throbbing desire. I have no way to get to sleep, and it's killing me. So I say, okay, if I masturbate, I'll have peace, and I can finally get to sleep. So I do, and guess what? The guilt is so strong I still can't get to sleep. I wake up totally exhausted in the morning. What's wrong with me? Do other men have this problem? I'm afraid to ask, really. What if this isn't how everyone else is? What would that say about me? Worse, what if this is how everyone else is? What would that say about the church? John wakes up early to watch those morning exercise shows, though he doesn't care much about fitness. The truth is, he began, I feel absolutely compelled to watch, to catch the close-ups of the buttocks, breasts, and especially the inner thighs, and I lust and lust and lust. I sometimes wonder if the producers doing those close-ups are just trying to hook men into watching their shows. Every day I tell myself that this will be the last time. But by next morning, I'm right there at the TV again. These men are not weirdos, but your next-door neighbors, your fellow workers, even your in-laws. They are you. They are Sunday school teachers, ushers, deacons. Even pastors aren't immune. One young pastor tearfully detailed to us his ministry and his desire to serve God, expressing in a deeply moving way his devotion to his call. But his tears turned to wrenching sobs as he spoke of his bondage to pornography. His spirit was willing, but his flesh was very weak. Spinning in the cycles. What about you? Maybe it's true that when you and a woman reach a door simultaneously, you wait to let her go first, but not out of honor. You want to follow her up the stairs and look her over. Maybe you've driven your rental car to the parking lot of a local gym between appointments, watching scantily clad women bouncing in and out, fantasizing and lusting, even masturbating in the car. Maybe you can't stay away from Sixth Avenue where the prostitutes ply their trade. Not that you'd ever hire one. Or maybe you don't buy Playboy back home, but when you're on a business trip, you just can't help yourself. You're still teaching Sunday school, still singing in the choir, still supporting your family. You've been faithful to your wife. Well, at least you haven't had an actual physical affair. You're getting ahead, living in a nice home with nice cars and nice clothes and a nice future. People look to me as an example, you reason. I'm okay. Yet privately, your conscience dims until you can't quite tell what's right or wrong anymore. Watching things like Forrest Gump without even noticing the sexuality. You're choking on the sexual prison you've made, wondering where the promises of God have gone. You spin in the same sinful cycles year after year. And nagging you is the worship, the prayer times, the distance, always the distance from God. Meanwhile, your sexual sin remains so consistent that you can set your watch by it. Rick, for instance, walks down the hall at break time just to glance through the glass doors of another office, where a bosomy secretary answers phones and directs clients. Every day at 9:30, I wave at her and she smiles back, he says wistfully. She's beautiful and her clothes, let's just say they really accentuate her best features. I don't know her name, but I'm actually depressed when she's absent from work. Similarly, Sid races home by 4 p.m. every summer day. That's when his neighbor Angela sunbathes right outside his window. At 4 o'clock, she lies out in a bikini, and she doesn't know I can see her. I can gaze to my heart's content. She's so sexy, I can hardly stand it, and I masturbate every day I see her. Take this test. Are these men addicted? The compelling sexual cravings are certainly strong evidence. Here's a little test you can take. You don't need a pencil, you just need to be honest with yourself. Answer yes or no to the following questions. 1. Do you lock on when an attractive woman comes near you? 2. Do you masturbate to images of other women? 3. Have you found your wife to be less sexually satisfying? 4. Are you holding a grudge against your wife, a grudge that gives you a sense of entitlement? 5. Do you seek out sexually arousing articles or photo spreads in newspapers or magazines? 6. Do you have a private place or secret compartment that you keep hidden from your wife? 7. Do you look forward to going away on a business trip? 8. Do you have behaviors that you can't share with your wife? 9. Do you frequent porn-related sites on the internet? And 10. Do you watch R-rated movies, sexy videos, or the steamy VH1 channel for gratification? If you've answered yes to any of these questions, you're lurking at the door of sexual addiction. You're inside that door if you can answer yes to the following questions. 1. Do you watch pay-per-view sexually explicit TV channels at home or on the road? 2. Do you purchase pornography on the internet? 3. Do you rent adult movies? 4. Do you watch nude dancing? 5. Do you call 900 numbers to have phone sex? And 6. Do you practice voyeurism? If you said yes to the last 6 questions, you very well could be sexually addicted. When Titus chapter 2 verse 3 admonishes against being addicted to much wine, the Greek word used for addicted means to be brought into bondage, much like a slave. If you think you're a slave to your sexual passions, then you need to get help for your addiction by talking to a counselor or a therapist. You can call toll-free 1-800-NEW-LIFE, 639-5433, and ask about treatment options. One option is a program for sex addiction called the New Liberty Program. From Steve, strong appetite or addiction? Before we go further, I need to make the point that it's easy to confuse normal sexual desire and conduct with addictive compulsions and gratification. A person can have a stronger than normal sexual appetite and not be a sex addict. I wrote about the characteristics of addictive sex in my book, Addicted to Love. These characteristics are summarized below. Read the list to help you distinguish between addictive sex and a stronger than normal sexual appetite. First, addictive sex is done in isolation and is devoid of relationship. This doesn't necessarily mean that it's done while physically alone. Rather, it means that mentally and emotionally, the addict is detached or isolated from human relationship and contact. Addictive sex is mere sex, sex for its own sake, sex divorced from the authentic interaction of persons. This is most clear regarding fantasy, pornography, and masturbation. But even regarding sex involving a partner, the partner isn't really a person, but a cipher, an interchangeable part of an impersonal, almost mechanical process. The most intimately personal of human behaviors becomes utterly impersonal. Second, addictive sex is secretive. In effect, sex addicts develop a double life, practicing masturbation, going to porn shops and massage parlors, all the while hiding what they're doing from others, and in a sense, even from themselves. Third, addictive sex is devoid of intimacy. Sex addicts are utterly self-focused. They cannot achieve genuine intimacy because their self-obsession leaves no room for giving to others. Fourth, addictive sex is victimizing. The overwhelming obsession with self-gratification blinds sex addicts to the harmful effects their behavior is having on others and on themselves. Fifth, addictive sex ends in despair. When married couples make love, they're more fulfilled for having had the experience. Addictive sex leaves the participants feeling guilty, regretting the experience. Rather than fulfilling them, it leaves them feeling more empty. And sixth, addictive sex is used to escape pain and problems. The escapist nature of addictive sex is often one of the clearest indicators that it is present. Like any addiction, sex addiction is progressive. It's like athlete's foot of the mind, as one person described it. It never goes away. It's always asking to be scratched, promising relief. To scratch, however, is to cause pain and to intensify the itch.